In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
And Sam looks down and sees the badge and his face flashes. And the chief goes, yeah! Oh, yeah!
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dyson.
Was Mr. Colbert ever in this greenhouse, say, last night about midnight?
Gillespie?
Yeah.
You saw it.
I saw it.
But what are you going to do about it?
I don't know.
I'll remember that. There was a time when I could have had you shot.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 165 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Jeremy Scott.
What the hell am I doing on the left? I'm never on the left.
I don't know.
Oh, there we go. Thank you.
Now we can have the show. The show can go on now that Jeremy is no longer on the left. We're also joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidly ho, Stigarinos.
Yes, Tigerinos. And we would like to welcome chat, who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Thank you guys for coming out. Let us start off with our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
And I will start us off with a movie that is in theaters right now. It's called Friendship. It stars Tim Robinson of I Think You Should Leave fame and Paul Rudd. Tim Robinson is playing a guy who is, I think he is a part of, he's a long-standing part of this neighborhood, and Paul Rudd is just moving in, and or something like that. It doesn't really matter. I can't remember who's getting in here first, but he gets a package for Paul Rudd at his own house, and he goes over to talk to Paul Rudd, and Paul Rudd likes him enough that he invites him out with his own friends. And Tim Robinson is playing a guy who's very, very awkward. He's somehow married to Kate Mara, which I have no idea how that happened, considering how awkward he is. He has a kid with her and everything. But he decides he's going to start hanging out with Paul Rudd, and they strike up a pretty good friendship. They go on this little adventure going through like the sewers of the town and stuff like that. And then Paul Rudd introduces him to his own friends. And that's where Tim Robinson kind of goes off the rails a little bit, and his awkwardness and his inability to really deal with social situations kind of comes to a head. This movie's very dark comedy. It is kind of like Cable Guy, only I think it might be darker than the Cable Guy.
Wow. Okay.
It's one of those movies where it really goes into some really extreme territory. It's still really funny in a lot of instances, but it's also like you feel bad for this guy because you're like, you know, he has something in him that he at least was able to do something good in his life where he got married and he had a kid and everything like this. But this new friend that's come in has sort of taken him, has made him go off the rails a little bit. But this is a really good movie. I would highly recommend it. It's in theaters right now. I imagine it's on its way to VOD pretty quickly. I don't think it's a huge hit or anything, but I really enjoyed this. It's something that just kind of stays with you after you watch it. So.
I'm very excited to see this. I may actually go out and see it later today. It's I think it's really interesting how Tim Robbins' career has gone, or Tim Robinson, I should say, because he was on SNL. Like people forget, like he was on SNL for a heartbeat, and his comedy just didn't. It wasn't the same frequency, and then for him to get to do I Think You Should Leave and show this is my frequency of sketch comedy, this is what I would have done on SNL kind of stuff, and for it to just blow up and for it to become so memed and people love it so much, and you know the hot dog sketch has become, you know, ubiquitous, everybody knows that one, and it's just like or the drive through sketch, they just break through even if you've never seen the show, and
doing something.
and I just, that's really cool. And so I'm really interested to see what a movie looks like, you know, with his vibe. Yeah. So
I gotta be honest, I like every sketch I've ever seen. I'm not sure a movie will work for me, but I sure want to give it a shot after hearing Chris talk about it. And I love Paul Rudd.
I'm telling you guys though, it's funny. It's got a lot of good moments, like good tender moments, whatever. It's dark as fuck. I'm not going to like, you know, sugarcoat it. Because there's just moments where you're like, oh, okay, finally this, and never like gives you that I don't know if I want to say anymore, but just, you know, it's just one of those type of things. Where you think that you know where it's going. This is a very good thing for this movie, by the way. You think you know where it's going, and then it kind of pulls you, you know, takes you on a left turn.
Nice.
in many instances. So
okay,
what do you got? What do you got for us, Jeremy?
Oh, I got something big and bold. I don't know what happened, but over the last 3 days, I racked up 4 small recommends. I'm stocked. Locked and loaded. My wife and I sat down to finally watch 2024's Count of Monte Cristo, French language, nominated for many awards. And it is 3 hours long. And like they say in the cliche, it goes by fast and you don't even feel it. To the point where my wife and I said, it's 3 hours. Let's watch an hour and a half today. I read there's an intermission. When we get to the intermission, we'll watch the rest tomorrow. And there's no intermission on the online version, and we didn't realize this until we were 45 minutes from the end, and we were just like, fuck, let's finish it. Oh, my God. Maybe I was just in the right mood, but this is everything we want big movies to be. The visuals are insane. The score is moving. The performances are great. The production scale is huge. I just was floored. All 3 hours of this thing, my wife and I both are big fans of the Kevin Reynolds, Jim Caviezel, Count of Monte Cristo. Still am, but that is now a popcorn film in my eyes compared to the way this film approaches the same material. I can't wait to watch it again. I can't wait to show it to my brother when he comes down in a few weeks. I cannot praise this enough. The only bad thing is you're going to have to rent it. If you want to watch it right now, it's not streaming for free anywhere. We got it for $5.99 on Amazon. Wish I'd paid the 20 whatever to just buy the thing. Love, 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 love.
This is an actual French adaptation too, right? Like this isn't, that's, I think that's a lot of times part of it is when the country of origin decides to go ahead and do a big production on something that's famous. They have like they figure out all the little nuances. And even when you watch this movie, you're probably not catching a lot of the nuances of the French culture, and especially French culture back in this day, and everything. But, I liked that last one that came out too. And I've wanted to watch this one for a while and it just slipped off the radar. So I'm going to have to watch it at some point.
Yeah, kind of same. It's one of those movies for me that just falls into that I have to be in the right place to start this. Like it feels, you know, big and meaningful and I love movie with subtitles, but that's a different watching experience than watching a movie without subtitles. And so I feel like, okay, I'm gonna watch this instead tonight, or I'm gonna watch this instead tonight. And so, but your recommendation has popped it up to the top.
And my wife turned to me halfway through and said, "The cinematography on this is amazing." Let me tell you how often she talks like that. almost never. This is a wow movie. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoy it when you watch it. I can't wait to hear what you think.
Yeah, excited to check it out. My small recommend is Final Destination Bloodlines. I, to some people's surprise, am a Final Destination fan. I have been since these movies debuted back in the day. And the reason for this is, even though I'm not a horror fan, I'm a real fan of quirky tone and cleverness. I love when a movie is clever, and these movies can be very, very clever. They set up a lot of fake outs and Easter eggs and hints, and it's like you're watching a murder mystery where the killer is death and you already know that, but the fun is figuring out how the murder's going to happen, not whodunit kind of idea. There is, you know, the gore is the gore. That's kind of a staple of the series as well. That's not necessarily the reason I watch, but it adds to the ridiculous tone, the way that these bodies are smashed apart or cut into pieces or whatever the case may be. Final Destination Bloodlines, if I were to sum it up in one phrase, it is understood the assignment. The directors of this understood what made those Final Destination movies interesting. And it, you know, it wasn't their sweeping social commentary or their awards potential or, you know, any of those big movie ideas. It's popcorn, fun, clever, Rube Goldberg machine kind of
Do
things.
Do you ever turn it off? Do you ever flip that switch off?
No, I don't know that I could. But in this movie has all of that. It has probably the most spectacular opening death premonition melee since the log truck. I think it competes with the log truck for the best. You know, the characters are as typically stupid and kind of non-essential as the other movies, but that kind of adds to the proceedings. And I don't know, it does something interesting with the lore as well, which I always like. I like when a movie can kind of world build the lore of what death is. I wish these movies would deal a little more with who's giving the premonitions, because it certainly can't be death. Like there's this other side of Final Destination that they hinted at. I think it was in either 3 or 4. I can't remember, where they hinted that there's another force that is doing the premonitions as opposed to
It's 3, I believe, because that's the one where they take pictures and stuff like that.
It's the Oracle.
It is the Oracle.
It's the Oracle, yes.
So I kind of hope in the next one they'll dig deeper into that part of the lore, but this is all about just hitting the marks, doing what you're supposed to do in a movie like this. It is a spectacular watch. I had a blast. If you like the Final Destination movies, there's a good chance you'll like this. Not a guarantee, but a good chance you'll like this as well. Because, I think they just understood the assignment. So it's good stuff.
I've seen all the other 5. I haven't seen this one yet. I have some catching up to do in movie theaters. Because there's quite a few that I've missed so far, but I saw Mission Impossible. Well, I got that out of the way.
Nice.
I don't mean to demean Mission Impossible. It's just one of those. It's one of those things.
It was your mission, and you chose to accept it.
That's right. It's one of those things. All right. Let's get on to our big recommend, which is In the Heat of the Night.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
And this one was my choice. And so I will start us off here. In the Heat of the Night is the 1967 winner for Best Picture. It won 5 Oscars overall, including a Best Actor Oscar for Rod Steiger. Norman Jewison lost Best Director to Mike Nichols for The Graduate. This is also the infamous year in which Sidney Poitier was in 3 films, including Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and To Sir With Love, and did not get nominated for any of them. At the beginning of the movie, to the tune of Ray Charles' title song, we see a train arriving in Sparta, Mississippi. We see a man we later will know as Virgil Tibbs, played by Poitier, step off that train and into the depot. We begin at a diner where the man behind the counter, who we later find out is Ralph, played by Anthony James, and a guy you might remember fights Frank Drebin in The Naked Gun, is swatting flies with a rubber band. Officer Sam Wood, played by Warren Oates, asks where the pie is, and the man tells him he sold the last piece. Ralph finds ways to lightly disrespect Officer Wood, and we find out there's a lot of pie left once he leaves. Wood then drives to a house where, in an action befitting of his surname, he spies a naked woman drinking a Dr. Pepper. Well, I suppose you see a lot of things on the beat. Off to downtown, where Officer Wood drives down a dark alley and discovers the dead body of Philip Colbert, a businessman building a factory that everyone is hoping will bring prosperity to Sparta. Sam calls in chewing gum chomping Chief Bill Gillespie, played by Steiger. There are no witnesses to this murder, but we do know his wallet has been stolen. Gillespie wants Sam to look around all the places that might still be open for a potential hitchhiker. Of course, Sam ends up at the train station where he finds Tibbs and is immediately racially hostile to him. After a shakedown, Sam discovers a fat wallet that he doesn't think Tibbs should have and tells him to get in the back of his squad car. Tibbs, realizing the danger of the situation, complies without saying a word. Wood takes Tibbs to Chief Gillespie, who is trying to get an air conditioner to stop making so much noise. The chief doesn't seem too interested in Wood's prisoner at first, telling Sam to leave. When Tibbs and Gillespie are alone, the chief is incredulous that Virgil was waiting for a train so early in the morning, and when Tibbs informs him that he was waiting on a 405 to Memphis, it's not long after we hear the sound of the train he just missed. Gillespie takes a seat next to the guns and then asks Tibbs for a confession. Tibbs' only confession is that he was trying to visit his mother. Gillespie points out the money in his wallet and that he must have stolen from Colbert, but Virgil says he earned the money by working 10 hours a day, 7 days a week as a Philadelphia police officer, punctuating the revelation by throwing his badge on Gillespie's desk. The chief calls Sam in and reprimands him for shoddy police work. Still, Gillespie isn't ready to just send Virgil on his way. They have to verify that he actually works for the PPD. After the photographer comes in and Wood allows Virgil to get a glimpse of the crime scene pictures, Gillespie calls him in to talk to his chief in Philly. Virgil's chief asks him to help the Sparta police with their murder investigation, and apparently he has no choice but to do so. His chief tells Gillespie that Virgil is their number one homicide expert. He doesn't think they'll need the help, which is why it's weird that after he hangs up, that's exactly what he asked Virgil to do. Virgil, off the hook, is reticent to do it now, but once he sees that Gillespie is in over his head, he relents. The first step is examining Colbert's body. Tibbs wants a whole bunch of stuff that Sparta isn't set up for, you know, sciencey stuff that can help with an investigation. Even without that, Virgil is able to figure out that Colbert was murdered well before the medical examiner's time frame of 2 to 2:30 a.m. Despite showing absolute incredible expertise, when Virgil asks for assistance, no one is immediately willing. Cut to a man, played by Scott Wilson, getting chased in the woods by dogs, a chase that eventually leads to a bridge at the Mississippi-Arkansas border on the Mississippi River. Hilariously, after a surefire escape, Chief Gillespie is waiting for the man on the bridge and catches up to him in his car. Back at the station, Virgil has to be the bearer of bad news for Colbert's wife, played by Lee Grant. After he leaves her alone to grieve, Gillespie comes back with the suspect and is ready to declare Philadelphia cops useless and science dead. Virgil is allowed to examine the suspect, which he silently does just before everyone declares victory. Virgil asks the throng of cops if the suspect confessed, which he did not. Virgil believes that the suspect is left-handed, which the cops believe he is, and left-handedness is apparently not the crime I thought it was, because it makes the suspect innocent of the murder. In Gillespie's office, we see that the suspect, Harvey, did have Colbert's wallet on him, which he claims to have found next to the victim and took, but that he did not kill the man. When the chief and Mrs. Colbert walk out to the front of the station, Virgil tells them he believes that Colbert was killed by a right-hander, and everyone in the town knows Harvey is a lefty. Gillespie doesn't appreciate this brainy method of crime fighting, makes fun of his name, casually throws a racial slur his way, and asks what they call him in Philadelphia, which leads to Virgil saying one of the all-time famous lines, "They call me Mr. Tibbs." The angry chief wants Virgil to go back to the train depot and get the hell out of here. Virgil tells Gillespie he's going to send his scientific findings to the FBI, but also suggests that it won't matter in this closed-minded town. Mrs. Colbert brings everything back into focus. Someone killed her husband, and she wants them to find out who. Still, when Virgil refuses to give his lab findings to Gillespie, the chief orders Wood to jail Virgil for withholding evidence. They throw him into the same cell with Harvey. Virgil tells Harvey he's on his side and that he's a cop, and they obviously threw him in there with him so he could get his side of the story. So Harvey explains that he saw the wallet next to Colbert and simply took it. Harvey believes he found the wallet after 2 a.m. and that from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. he was shooting pool at a bar, and he's got an alibi for that time frame. He also mentions that he's been in trouble with the law before, claiming that when he went on a date with this woman named Dolores Purdy, who was taking off her clothes in front of him, peeping officer Wood jumped out of the bushes to arrest him for being more attractive to women than he is. Turns out, this is the same woman that Wood came by to take a peek at earlier in the movie. Virgil examines Harvey's right hand and finds some Q-chalk that corroborates his pool story. Gillespie comes by with a waiver he wants Virgil to sign because of his false arrest, and then lets him out. After he's let out, Virgil springs some more knowledge on the chief that the time of death was around 12:30, which is when Harvey was shooting pool. Furthermore, Virgil says that Colbert wasn't killed where he was found. When Virgil leaves, the chief changes Harvey's charge to simple theft. Gillespie then has to go into town and tell Mrs. Colbert that her husband's murderer is still at large. Mrs. Colbert informs Gillespie that she wants Tibbs on the case, citing the fact that Gillespie and his crew are incompetent. If he doesn't, then Mrs. Colbert will take the factory that her husband was building elsewhere. So Gillespie has to go to the train depot and continue his eating shit tour. The chief tries to dangle the fact that many people of color would be able to get jobs at the new factory, and a lot is riding on this, hoping that will be enough to keep him here. When that doesn't work, Gillespie taunts him, telling him that he must really be aching to show up all these white cops with his knowledge. Silently picking up his suitcase, Virgil acknowledges that this is what's going to keep him here. Gillespie goes to a black auto mechanic and gets Virgil set up with a car, then leaves. After explaining who he is, the auto mechanic offers him a room in his own house. The powers that be have a meeting with Gillespie where they lay out the risk of having Virgil trying to solve this murder. There's a belief that Virgil won't even survive the investigation in this town, and if that happens, then what does Mrs. Colbert do? Virgil asks Mrs. Colbert who her husband's enemies are. One name that comes up is Eric Endicott, played by Larry Gates, who is super wealthy and basically runs the county. Mrs. Colbert puts the time that her husband left the house around 11 p.m. Then Virgil inspects Colbert's car, in which Virgil finds blood on the passenger seat and some local flora on the brake. Gillespie stops by to see how he's doing, and Virgil says he wants to question Eric Endicott. Endicott grows cotton on his farm, tended to by mostly black people, a fact of which Gillespie cannot let go when he tells Virgil that's a job he must be too good for. They meet Endicott in a greenhouse. When Virgil states his preference for the epiphytes, Endicott says, of course, that's because they need care and feeding and cultivating just like black people do. While there, Virgil finds the same fern root he found in Colbert's car. When Gillespie wants to leave, Endicott asks why they're here in the first place, and Virgil tells him delicately that Endicott stood to gain from his death more than anyone. When Virgil asks if Colbert was ever in this greenhouse, Endicott forgets that he's not living in the 1860s and slaps Virgil for the question, which Virgil immediately returns and is dumbfounded that Gillespie isn't arresting Virgil for such a slight. Endicott tells Virgil that there was a time he could have had him killed and no one would do anything about it. When they leave, he cries. Gillespie wants Virgil gone, and when Virgil says he thinks he can solve this case and bring the likes of Endicott down, Gillespie gives him the condescending, "Oh, ain't that sweet? You think you're people." When Gillespie tells the mayor agrees Virgil needs to go, and Mrs. Colbert is conveniently out of town until Thursday, so she'll be okay with whatever they did with Virgil if they solve the case. The mayor tells Gillespie the last chief would have shot Virgil and claimed self-defense, so why is he different? When Gillespie asks the station if Virgil's left yet, he is told that Virgil refused to go. He tries to track him down as a bunch of racist asses try to run Virgil off the road. The chase ends up on foot in an old train depot where he is surrounded. He fends them off long enough for Gillespie to catch up. After they mouth off with racist bullshit, Gillespie punches one of them and they're sent on their way. He tells Sam Wood to get him out of town, but Virgil resists, and they go to the diner we saw earlier in the movie. Gillespie confronts him about it, and when he asks that what Virgil wants, he says, "I want to know where Sam Wood was all night." After briefly entering the diner and discovering that Ralph, the diner guy, is also super racist, Wood tells Virgil he left the diner at 2:40 a.m. Then we retrace his steps, starting with a call to the station, then a drive towards the house where Sam peeped on the naked woman, but taking an odd route and skipping over the part where he actually stopped and looked inside. The route Wood takes is not lost on Virgil, who asks why he did that. Wood gets offended, and Virgil ends up walking out of the car. Gillespie goes to a bank to look at some documents. He finds out that Sam deposited a little over $600 just yesterday, and since Virgil caught him in a lie, he's convinced that Wood is his man. Sam claims he got it from gambling. Gillespie believes that Colbert cashed a check for $900. Wood killed him over it, deposited $600, and left $300 in the wallet that was found near him. Of course, Gillespie's thought process on this is downright stupid, because it's all based on Virgil noticing Wood changing his route. Only after the accusations fly, does Gillespie ask Virgil about this, and Virgil tells him that he already knew the answer, that Sam was ashamed about his peeping. Gillespie is still convinced that Wood is the guy, and Virgil once again has to tell him he's wrong about this, but he is once again sent down to the train depot to leave town. Right then, a Mr. Purdy, played by James Patterson, comes in with his exhibitionist sister, Dolores, played by Quentin Dean. Purdy tells Gillespie that Dolores is going to have Sam's baby. She claims Sam seduced her to go make whoopee in a cemetery. Gillespie asks if he forced her or if she let him, which the brother says is immaterial because she's 16. Virgil goes to the jail to talk to Harvey and asks where women can get abortions in this town. He knows of someone, but only his friend would know where she is. He arranges for his buddy to show up to the jail. Virgil then goes to inspect the land where the factory is being built. He finds a wooden stake that matches the wood they found in Colbert's scalp. Virgil says three people saw Colbert drive by on the way to Endicott's. There's a lot of details, by the way, that Virgil finds out that the movie doesn't find out until he says it. He must have picked up somebody and then came out to the factory site with someone who picked up one of these stakes and hit him over the head with it. Virgil believes that Colbert was killed at the site and the killer drove Colbert in his own car and his body dumped on the street. It couldn't have been Sam because he would have had to drive two cars at the same time. He then tells Gillespie that even he made a mistake focusing on Endicott for personal reasons. Gillespie gives Virgil until morning to solve the case. Back at Gillespie's house, he tells Virgil about the lonely life he leads. Virgil himself has had to live a lonely life, but at least he's been close to being married. When Gillespie asks if he gets lonely, Virgil says, "No more than you," to which Gillespie takes offense. He doesn't want pity. This is his choice, after all. There's a knock on the door. It's Packy, played by Matt Clark, who is Harvey's buddy. Virgil gets into Packy's car, and they drive to a predominantly black part of town where Virgil meets a Mrs. Bellamy, a.k.a. Mama Kaliba, played by Bea Richards, and asks her who is paying for Dolores Purdy's abortion. Virgil tells her that the man paying for this abortion has more money than he's let on because he stole $600 after killing Colbert. This staggers Mama Kaliba, who is hesitant to give the name, but Virgil explains that colored time is much worse than white person time in jail. She then tells Virgil she doesn't know the name, but that Dolores is coming here tonight. When she arrives, she runs at the sight of Virgil, who chases after her. A voice from the shadows turns out to be Ralph, not just a killer of flies, it seems. Virgil accuses him of Colbert's murder, and then the racist-ass posse shows up, including Dolores' brother. Virgil tells the surrounding posse to look in Dolores' purse for $100 she's going to use for an abortion, money she got from Ralph, who convinced Dolores' brother that Sam Wood was the father. The posse forgets about their racism to focus more on their hatred for dudes who bang their underage sisters and try to pay for their abortions. Ralph shoots Dolores' brother, and Virgil grabs Ralph. Ralph then claims that after he left Dolores' house that he hitched a ride with Colbert, and on the way he asked for a job at the factory, which Colbert apparently said he would grant. Colbert drove him to the field where the factory was being built, and Ralph's intention was to tap Colbert on the head and claim they were jumped by someone in the bushes. I don't get any of the story, by the way. And while I believe this story, I have no idea what this was supposed to accomplish. Oh, well, I guess he's crazy. Did he leave the part out where there was a fly on the back of Colbert's head that he was and he was out of rubber bands? I don't know. I have no idea why he even wanted to hit this guy. He says something like he was just asking for it. And I'm like, the guy said he was going to give you a job, man. I don't know. Gillespie takes Virgil back to the train depot for what must be the 25th time he's been there this movie. They shake hands. Gillespie tells him to take care, and they have a knowing moment where they hated each other, and now they tolerate each other. Virgil gets on the train, and Ray Charles sends us out, and that's the movie. Guys, what did you think of In the Heat of the Night?
I'll start. I love this movie. I saw it for the first time just recently, within the last 4 years, I think. Finally got around to it, and it blew me away, primarily, I think, for the two central performances. I think both Sidney and Poitier and Rod Steiger are phenomenal in this movie. I think they are asked to do so much internal acting, and they both do it so well. There is a fine line when a movie is trying to give humanity and authenticity and empathy to a racist character like the Rod Steiger character. That fine line can come off as, oh, it's a good racist, you know, if you do it wrong. And
right.
I think his performance nails the fact that we never once forget that he has a terrible worldview on race or, race relations, those kind of things, that he has these racist thoughts and ideas, while at the same time allowing him to be a full and complete human being and have a place that you know, comes from, and giving him the moment in the house where he's, you know, talking about being alone and having nothing. And it's a really interesting moment where the movie allows this moment between them, because he's been dealing with so much of what he says in this movie is about this idea of racial castes, where, you know, I'm not saying this is, again, is the racist idea of this. I'm not saying you're, you know, less valuable as a human because you're black. I'm just saying you have a place in society that you're supposed to be because you're black, and differentiating between that and your warped, you know, idea of the world. And he's dealing with you'll hear the word uppity a lot in these old movies, the idea like, you know, you're trying to get beyond where you're supposed to be. And he's dealing with a black man that is just living a full human life outside of these more overt racisms of the South that would put him in that place. And so this man, this white man, is dealing with a complete upending of his idea of society. And as he's doing that, you know, you can imagine him thinking, well, at least I'm not, you know, as alone and empty as I am, at least I'm not black. You know, I'm not a black person. I don't have to live with that, you know, part of my life. And now he's realizing that even a black person can have more than him, be above him, make more money than him, you know, those kind of things. That's a really tricky thing to do in a movie like this. And I think the movie does it really, really well. And I think those performances are the central reason. A couple other things I wanted to say. Just moments and stuff that popped out to me. Scott Wilson showing up. I mean, come on. Like, he is like one of the most that guys to ever be in movies. And to see an early performance here by him, and a central performance to the movie. It's not, you know, really tangential. It's a very important part. You know, long before he was Herschel from The Walking Dead, you know, to be here was really interesting. You mentioned the way he mentions he's a cop and emphatically putting the badge down. The beauty of that scene for me is just the patience that character has just to endure, knowing he's got this trump card eventually that he's going to have to do or get to do or whatever, and just waiting to give that information at the most impactful time, I thought was really cool. There are bits of humor in this movie that help make it work. The idea when he's talking about him being left-handed and Steiger comes out and all the other deputies are like, yeah, we figured out he was left-handed, and they're taking like the credit for what Virgil had done. Mm-hmm. the laugh that the mechanic gives when Virgil says he'll just get a hotel is so perfect, and it says so much without having to say anything. I really loved that. Of course, the slap back is just it's essential cinema. It's just something that is ingrained in cinema history, and it should be. It's amazing. This movie, watching it for the first time recently, made me hate The Lion King retroactively. Because in The Lion King, when they call me Mr. Pig. And I'm just like, how do you take the pathos of this moment and turn it into a warthog saying, like, I just, once I realized where that came from and what that was about, that's a little annoying to me. And then the final thing I'll talk about is the murder mystery part, which isn't the part people necessarily go to this movie for, but it's there, and they set it up pretty nicely. There's some subtle exposition. You mentioned the drive-by early on is, you know, setting up what we need to know about those characters. Right from the beginning, he's flicking flies and hiding cake in the diner or pie in the diner, and, you know, so we're learning things without knowing we're learning them. I'm not sure it's a great, like you mentioned, the eventual motive. Like, I'm not sure that's like a great hold together murder mystery, but it is played well. It is set up well, you know, and it is a part of the movie beyond even the social ramifications of what this movie is trying to say, which, you know, I'm just tired of these modern woke Hollywood movies. We need to go back to a day when there were no woke movies trying to make social points.
Because they certainly didn't have them back in the day. They sure didn't.
Let's go back to 60 years ago when there were no movies like that. This movie's great. This movie's phenomenal. Loved it.
Racism, this is what I get from this movie this time through. Racism and bigotry in general requires you to see another race or class of people as not people, as less than. All throughout this movie, people are either shocked or genuinely angry when Tibbs simply doesn't behave the way they expect him to. Four thugs attacking him in that depot, and he says, why don't you come get it, baby, or whatever he says, and that enrages them, that he's not already bowing to them. That's reality. I wrote down a bunch of notes that Aaron already stole my thunder on. let me go through some of them. I absolutely love seeing film artifacts on older movies when I'm watching them. Like, I'm talking about imperfections, scratches, little blotches or what have you. I don't know why. Maybe it's the former projectionist in me, but it just makes me feel comfy when I'm watching a movie on my HD 4K TV and I see little scratches and little imperfections in the film go by. There is an all-time line reading in this movie when he calls in Sam and shows him the wallet. And Sam looks down and sees the badge, and his face flashes. And the chief goes, yeah! Oh, yeah! And it's just amazing that someone would even script that and think that everything could be conveyed in those three words. But it is. It's perfect. He's saying so much to everyone in the room with that line reading. I love the music that plays when the chief slowly walks towards Tibbs at the train station, like almost hand in hand. Like, it's the perfect, like, I wish I didn't have to be here, but here I have to go. And I have to ask this guy for help. I think it's worth pointing out that the chief, in addition to being racist and morally compromised, I think he might have a touch of narcissistic personality disorder, in that he's almost incapable until the very last scene of admitting any trace of wrong or defeat, to the point where even at the train depot, as you said, Chris, when you were recapping, he tries to sell Tibbs on, like, this is good for black people for you to come back. He has to bring him back to the investigation at that point because the widow's demanding it. But he still won't just say, will you please come back? He has to try and make it. Anyway, it's a very, very fascinating character, and I think he deserved to win. I just don't know why Sidney didn't win. Enough has been said about the slap, but that's just another moment where everyone is completely shocked that the black man didn't behave the way he was, quote unquote, expected to or supposed to. And I'm glad that you pointed out that he's crying. I wrote that in all caps. He's crying like a baby when they leave. Let's see. The police arrest three innocent people for the murder before finally finding the right one. I think that's interesting to point out. Because in addition to being racist, this is a corrupt chief. He may not like steal from people, but there's corruption here in plain sight. I just really, really loved it. I've seen it now three times. I want to know. Here, help me understand this. How does the TV show take this ending and somehow pair the two of them up for every episode for however many seasons the show ran? How do they take this ending and go, they're going to be buddies. They're going to be partnered up for life. Like, how did that? I never saw the show. I just want to know narratively, how did they explain that?
And I even watched the show, but I didn't know really about the movie when I watched the show. So I couldn't tell you on that either because I don't remember much about the show anymore. But that is an interesting thing, isn't it? They just kind of like they took Sparta, Mississippi, which obviously not many murders happen at all. And then they turned it into like Murder, She Wrote, where there's murders happening all the time in the TV show. So I don't know. It is an interesting, thing. Like, I think when you compare this movie to, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, you start thinking, does Sidney Poitier have to play the absolute perfect black man in these movies every single time? In Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, I think it gets to the point of absolute silliness because, the parents are liberal, but they've got their prejudices. But I feel like only a couple of things would have swayed them a little bit more than this movie, that movie, which kind of like you have to hammer them over the head with the fact that he's a doctor and that, you know, he's just a million different things that are positive and everything. In this movie, I think it works for it. And the reason why is think about if the bar wasn't this high for him when he goes down to Sparta and all of this. Think about what would have happened to him then if he had not set the bar so high. Just think about any other black person getting into this situation that doesn't have his credentials and everything. That would have been gone a completely different way. Probably ends up dying in the movie too. That's the other part of this, and I do think it works a lot for him. I watched the commentary on this movie, and one of the things that they talked about with Sidney Poitier was that he was very revered, in the black community, and he always felt like he needed to have that pure of heart in everything that he did, or else he was letting his fans down and everything. So that's why I feel like you see him in these type of roles where he's he's above everybody else and intelligent and intelligence and style and things of that nature. And it's one of those things that it must have been hard for him to have to maintain that kind of angelic presence at all times and all of his movies and everything like that. And it reminded me a little bit of the Jackie Robinson story, which is, Jackie Robinson was not picked because he was the best black ball player. He was picked because he was the guy who was going to be able to act right more than anybody else. And like, if you ever see that movie, it's not the 42 movie that came out, but there was an HBO movie that came out that talked about all of the Negro League players and everything. And it was talking about how Josh Gibson, who's played by Michael T. Williamson, he was probably the best and they wouldn't let him in because he didn't have the attitude to deal with it. So Jackie Robinson ended up being the guy. And so it's like you had to be absolutely perfect to get into these white worlds. And that's one of those things that you realize watching Sidney Poitier back in these days is that it's he always had to be perfect.
They didn't shoot in Mississippi because they were worried that people would make threats or attacks. They shot in Illinois, I think, but they did go down to Tennessee to shoot for the cotton farm scene, and Poitier got threats, death threats at his hotel, so they packed up early and left. And this was, so it's portraying in the film what was actually happening in real life while they were filming the film. It's just, it's,
In the chat, Nolan, you say that's not actually true about Jackie Robinson. What's not true about Jackie Robinson? That's what I'd like to know, because I've watched a lot of things on Jackie Robinson.
I think he's saying he was a better ball player than...
Yeah, he was a great ball player, don't get me wrong, but there were many others who were great that they didn't let in because he had the temperament to do it. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about, oh, he was terrible or anything like that. So, and yes, he wasn't so mild-mannered. There were some moments in his life, but like he had to act a certain way or else he was not going to be allowed in. That's basically what it came down to. So yes, nobody is just one thing. They have a lot of other things. There's a famous story about Jackie Robinson not wanting to dine at a restaurant because they wouldn't serve black people. So he told the team, you know, we're not going to spend money here. And they all decided not to eat at that restaurant. So yes, he wasn't so mild mannered, but he had to do that. And that's why I feel like Sidney Poitier had to be a lot of times, or at least he put that pressure on himself to be that way. So anyway, let's get on to the, super secret double feature.
Offer valid on standard browsers, U.S. only.
When I heard about Date My Age, I thought, really? But there I was in my empty, quiet house, my laptop on the kitchen counter, and I typed in my name. Looking for a man between the ages of 40 to 60? Sure, why not?
Date My Age is different. With verified profiles, you can feel safe and secure to explore meaningful connections with interesting and mature singles.
Date My Age made it really easy. I could join and view online profiles for free. All of a sudden, my empty house wasn't so quiet anymore. I got so much attention, it just made me feel seen and alive. Date My Age helped me start a totally new chapter in my life.
Find a friend, a lover, a partner at Date My Age. Get 60% off when you join at datemyage.com today. That's datemyage.com to connect with thousands of singles worldwide. datemyage.com.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
And I don't know, Jeremy. Let's start off with you.
You rat bastard. Well, I think Aaron's probably a bit more clever than me. I'm not going to name any of my alternates. I'm going with a movie that I think has a lot of the same themes: Southern, racist, corrupt police chief confronting a black man in his jurisdiction who refuses to back down. But this is modern times. It's Rebel Ridge on Netflix. I think Rebel Ridge and In the Heat of the Night would be an excellent bookend around a discourse conversation about racism in the South and the police. So, that's the one I went with. I kept thinking about it all movie long. There was one other one that felt like a little too obvious, and I won't say it now in case Aaron picked it. Go.
I might have. I did pick a pretty obvious one. I believe the chat has already called it low-hanging fruit. And that is Black Klansman. And I think the reason I like this as a double feature is I was really looking for something where there was an investigative team up about race, where the investigators were learning about each other, and this fit that bill to me. This is one I need to, I've only seen this once, and I really need to do a rewatch on this because I remember having some mixed feelings, but really liking it, really coming out strong on it. And I'd love to go back and kind of give it a fresh view sometime soon. But yeah, Black Klansman. I did think of some of the others the chat mentioned. Knives Out is a sneaky good double feature here with the racial angle of that movie. But I really did want something where the investigators were kind of the heart of the double feature. So Black Klansman.
I like it.
Spike Lee. Spike Lee still got it, man. I'm hearing that Higher and Lower is good too. So nice. I'm excited to see that as well. But all right, I think those are some good choices. I really like both of those quite a bit. All right, on to what our next week's homework is. I believe it's Jeremy's turn. So Jeremy, what are we watching next week?
We're finally gonna do it, chat. And I don't think Slab is here today, but whenever he listens to this or watches this, he will be very happy to know that with the U.S. Open golf tournament approaching in a couple of weeks, we are doing Tin Cup. This is one of my very favorite movies. This is definitely one of my favorite sports movies of all time. I've seen it bazillions of times, and I have wanted to talk about it on the show since we started recommending on Recotopia, and I cannot wait to go back to it. Unfortunately, from my research, it's rent only this week, but I think several of you have seen it before, so maybe you won't have to watch it anew in order to appreciate the conversation. But Tin Cup, I can't wait.
Yeah, I love this movie a lot. This is Ron Shelton's sports follow-up to Bull Durham, and they go along pretty well. Not to take anybody's super secret double features if that happened. But I love Tin Cup, and I wasn't even a big golf fan when I first watched this movie in theater, so I'm excited to watch this again. This is a really entertaining movie. All right, let's go on. We got time for some questions, so let's go on to some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
And let's see what we got here. Question that I have on the list here is, what are some places to watch events, i.e. movie theaters, concerts, sporting venues, etc., that you consider to be bucket list places everyone should go at least once? For example, I feel like anyone who visits Nashville should go to the Grand Ole Opry and the Ryman Auditorium at least once during their trip. And as Nashville people, Jeremy and I, and I don't know, you don't think you've been to those places, have you, Aaron? Have you been to Grand Ole Opry or Ryman?
I've definitely been to the Ryman a few times. I've actually never gone to the Grand Ole Opry. So much so, in fact, that it was just this year when visiting Nashville that I realized Grand Ole Opry is actually right there at Opry Mills. I had no clue.
It used to be, I think, well, the Ryman used to be the Grand Ole Opry.
That's what I thought. I thought it was in downtown at one point, but it's there at Opry Mills now. So, but I haven't been.
All right. I think we can all vouch for those being good venues. Anyway, what do you guys think on this question?
I'm tired of the chat stealing my answers. It's Red Rocks in Colorado. Would love to see one of my four or five favorite artists in that venue. Just because visually, I think it looks like a really completely unique venue, but also audio wise, it's supposed to be a really good venue. I've been to Colorado once, and it was to the airport, and I was just on a layover. I didn't even leave the airport. But that is a place I would love to see a concert someday.
Yeah, me too.
I picked a few here, a couple in LA that I want to mention. One would be Grauman's, technically not Grauman's anymore, but
yeah, right.
TLC, I can't remember, TCL.
I don't even know what they call it now.
But that's an experience to watch. I watched one of the I think it was right. No, the first What's the first of the Star Wars 7? What's the 7 called?
Rise of Skywalker.
It's
Force Awakens.
Force Awakens. I saw the Force Awakens there when it came out, and that was a great experience. I'd also mention The Egyptian, which Netflix bought and has totally refurbished and to make it look like the old school Egyptian. That's a really cool place to watch a movie. The two others, in Vegas, you have to see a show at the Sphere. I mean, it's just that's a bucket list place, I think, with the technology there. Is pretty incredible. And then I had to mention the Big House, Michigan Stadium in Michigan, still the world's largest football stadium. 107,000 people watching a football game together is quite an experience.
It's also a good way to catch a cold.
Just because it's Michigan or all those people?
All those people, 100,000 people in the same place? Thank you, no.
The other interesting thing about Michigan Stadium that I love is when you walk up to it, it doesn't look that big because a lot of it's underground. Like, you don't realize how much of the bowl is underground. So you, like, walk in and it's just this huge thing. But, yeah, Michigan Stadium's great. Yeah,
Camden Yards is the same way in Baltimore.
Yeah.
You don't realize that, like, two-thirds of it is sunken underground when you walk in there.
It's a cool
effect.
You
walk in on the sidewalk and you're like above the second level. Yeah, it's awesome.
Cool stuff. Man, every sporting venue I've ever been to, even the legendary ones, I don't like generally. Like, I don't know. The Braves have a newish park called Truist Park that I've been to, and it's good. I just don't think I've ever been to a baseball stadium and went, wow, this is amazing. Like, I went to Fenway Park. For a baseball fan, that's like one of the top places that you ever want to go to see a game. Now, my seat wasn't great, but it was also like, oh, is this what all it is? Oh, okay. The Green Monster's kind of cool for the first inning.
Yeah.
And then after that, you're done.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then Yankee Stadium, the old Yankee Stadium, I went to that, and that was fine. And what else? There's several that I'm just like, okay, those are fun. I'm glad I went. That Wrigley Field is good. I would say Wrigley Field is worth it, but I also, because, and chat stole mine as well, but I think if you want to go to a movie in Nashville, you want to go to the Belcourt. And the Belcourt is a place that they have renovated in the last many years. It looks completely different than it used to when you walked up to it. The one thing that's good about it, though, is they kept the inside auditoriums on the bottom floor the exact same, essentially. They changed some seats out and stuff, but those theaters look almost exactly like they did when you were going to see movies way back in the day. So I'm glad that they at least kept that aesthetic, and that theater really does believe in presenting the movie well and having a good experience and everything. In New York, I went to several different movie theaters, and as far as chain theaters go, the AMC Lincoln is one of my favorite theaters of all time. It is a movie palace. Hmm. It is absolutely the way you should make a giant movie theater slap dab in the middle of Manhattan. It is beautiful. I saw 2001 in IMAX there. Fantastic. I saw There Will Be Blood there. That movie, that theater is exactly what a movie lover's dream is all about. Hmm. So
yeah, they did the press screening for Avatar: The Way of Water there, and I just happened to be in town for a Netflix event and got to see that at that theater is insane. It is so good.
Yeah,
I second that one for sure.
The comments did largely gloss over what we eventually said, but Nolan said Red Rocks Amphitheater. R1MA78 says Lincoln Center, which is would be a cool place to see something, I'm for sure. Josh mentioned the Belcourt. Nolan said the Sphere in Vegas. Josh says, I'd love to see an outdoor show anywhere in Australia. I think I'm going to be wrapped up in snakes and scorpions watching something outside. That's what I know about Australia, is that it's just nothing but dangerous animals everywhere and everybody's dying all the time. Mm-hmm. Did see Paul McCartney at Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati. Those pyrotechnics during Live and Let Die are still literally the loudest noise I've ever heard. Nolan says, same with Wrigley. 8 says, watching a hockey game in Yankee Stadium was fun. James James tells me to watch my mouth, signed a New Englander. And James also says the AMC Boston Common is pretty rad. There's a ceiling absolutely covered in movie quotes. I like that. Cool. I like that a lot. I love it. I love the experience of being in a place that really cares about movies, or at least the facade shows you that they care about movies. And I think it's pretty awesome. Anyway, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you, chat, for coming out. Once again, we appreciate you very much for coming out and watching us talk about movies today. Next week is Tin Cup. Can't wait to go over that one again. That's a really fun movie. Can't wait to hear hear Jeremy's excited synopsis of Tin Cup, which has one of my favorite moments in movie history in it. But that's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Les poissons. How I love little fish, Les Poissons.
We were watching yesterday the new Birbiglia special on Netflix, which is, Chris and I saw this in December.
In Nashville? Our,
what's that?
In Nashville?
Yeah, with our better halves. And then he filmed it and turned it into the special, and it's really funny. But there's a thing in there where, wait, am I thinking of the wrong guy? I'm thinking of the wrong guy. Never mind. That special's great, and I'm going to small recommend it again in the future. But I was watching a different stand-up, and he was doing a funny British accent. And I can't remember the joke, and now I wish I hadn't opened my mouth at all, because he was basically...
There are plenty of things that change in time, and our understanding of how things might affect people change in time. But, you know, when I was messing around with my, you know, voice, my instrument growing up, I imitated everybody. Like, it was, you know, I didn't even think about, you know, race, or, you know, that it might possibly make somebody feel less than or othered, or, you know, that I was, you know, appropriating a culture that wasn't mine, and that I had, you know, the privilege to appropriate the fun parts of that culture, but also not experience the absolute trauma of that culture. Like... You know, I grew up loving hip hop culture, you know, and it was just so a lot of my mannerisms kind of went that direction. I was in a rap group, you know what I mean? Like, it was, so it's just interesting to process how our ability to have empathy and think of others changes through time, and the ability to parse those things.
A lot of it is circumstance, right?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Like, I grew up in all white towns in Indiana,
right,
until I was 16.
Yeah.
I'm talking towns of 5,000, 2,000, where there just weren't any people of color.
Right.
And that put me behind the curve in terms of all the stuff you're talking about, just because of straight up ignorance. And but I don't think anybody expects teenagers to like fully understand appropriation and empathy. And
I don't know, some people on the internet do. I mean, some people on the internet are you know, ready to call everything out, understandably so, but it's like, you know, we have to give some room for growth and grace.
I mean, at the same time,
we can cut all of this out. Chris is like, what have I popped into?
teenagers today have a lot more access to information and education and discourse on these topics that we did not have access to when we were 15 and 16 years old. That's not to say
it's true.
There's anyone telling them to seek it out,
they still have the same stupid underdeveloped brains that we did. Right,
exactly.
Jeremy, did you watch Last of Us Season 2?
Yes.
Well, oh, okay. Tell me your thoughts. I read something into your yes, but tell me your thoughts.
What you read into my yes is that I loved it, but the online discourse is exhausting. But there was an episode, there was a moment in the last episode that was maybe one of the biggest gut punches any show has ever given me. And it took me several minutes to recover. I'm loving it. I think all the actors are killing it. I have the benefit of having played half of the second game, so I know some of where this is going. But yeah, what about you? Are you enjoying it?
I'm 2 for 2 on seasons that I really get into, and then the finale just lets me down. Like, I hate both the finales of season one and season two. I think the easiest way to say it is the show is in possibly the game, because I haven't played the game, are interested in doing something that I don't find interesting. They seem like the least interesting way to resolve both season one and season two to me.
But I would say that I think it's a fair argument that the second season of this show is similar to the third season of The Bear in that it doesn't necessarily feel like a complete season. It feels like, you know, Dune Part One, where it's definitely a rug pull, you know, cliffhanger. And I don't necessarily, in fact, when it ended, I went, you got to be fucking kidding me. But again, I know at least the next few steps. So I don't know. I'm less bothered by that, I guess. But I'm looking forward to season three, because I think we're going to get a lot more Caitlin Dever. And
they're talking about 4 seasons now, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
That feels like a mistake.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.